like to bring this meeting to order. It is 8:10. We were held up by technical difficulties as well as our organization here. Thursday, February 17th, and Representative Elkin is present. Representative Gardner, Representative Lynn, Representative Gatto, Chair Seaton. And I'd like to remind everybody to turn off their cell phones. And also today we have two items on our agenda, HB 94 elections, as well as HB 98, which is non-union public employee salary and benefits. We're going to start with continuation with Division of Elections and HB 94. And I would like to also announce that we had scheduled a meeting for Saturday, and we are not we don't have a quorum for that meeting, so we are going to have a work session on Saturday. It's starting at 10 o'clock. We've invited folks from all around the building, including the other side, the other body. And so hopefully we'll be joined by some Senate folks that want to look at the basis of the PERS and TERS issue. So the work session on Saturday will be looking at PERS and TERS, and we will, if people want to join us by teleconference, we will be able to request that ability, or we are requesting to have that teleconference. It will be an informal work session, but it's such a large subject, and looking at all the different parameters, understanding all the actuarial calculations and how we've gotten ourselves into a problem, a $5.6 billion problem, we need to find out and start moving on figuring out solutions. So that will be on Saturday, and so I want to make sure that everybody that's concerned with that, which is all state employees and unions, employers, and all, please join us for those considerations. And we will have that recorded so that the members that aren't present will be able to catch up on the work that we do on that, at that work session.
Mr. Chairman, you said 10?
Yes, at 10 o'clock, this room on Saturday. Okay, is there any other business before we get started on the elections bill to come before the committee? Okay, so with that, we'll start with HB 94, and Laura Glazier, would you come join us? And we sure appreciate all the attention that you are giving us, and all the extra time to meet with folks to try and smooth through some of these amendments and get them in the right order, so we don't have to make amendments to amendments quite so often. Laura, do you have a anything further on the bill? I think we went through all the sections and started amending the bill. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Laura Glazier, Director, Division of Elections. That's correct. We were, I believe, on it was amendment number 2, Representative Gardner's, and we started the discussion, but I don't, and that was to the G version.
That was to the G version. And so since we have that amendment to the G version, I think that we will continue with the discussion on Representative Gardner's amendment. Do you want to briefly go back over the amendment?
Okay. I believe that, this is an amendment that is designed to simply assure people of the accuracy of machine counting. And there was a question raised about the definition of the State Ballot Counting Review Board, and I believe that that has been resolved. It is something that's already specifically defined and includes representatives from both parties. Then the other question was raised about in line page 1, line 14, a hand count of ballots from one randomly selected precinct in each election district that accounts for at least 5% of the ballots count in the district will be hand counted. And I believe we're going to exclude any district which only hand counts, since the point is to check the machine work.
Okay, and might I interrupt just to draw everybody's attention that that is now listed as G9 in your amendment package?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yes.
G9 Do we need to adopt latest CS?
No, we had our amendment was dealing with the G version, and so I think that...
Because we now have a new, it's not, it's not the G version anymore, we're now on the F as in Foxtrot version. It's going reverse alphabetical order, and this is a matter of housekeeping.
No, we haven't adopted that CS, and I, the original amendment was offered to the G version. Representative Gardner, G9, is that addressing those sections and lines? Do you know whether that addresses the G or the F version? No, that is to the...
To G version.
To the G version, so we still have...
We can do the...
We still have the G version for us, and then we will, we have some amendments that we selected to the G version, and we will roll those amendments into, if we adopt the new CS, we'll adopt those amendments into that. So this amendment is to the G version, G9 is the... So Representative Gardner, sorry for the interruption, I just wanted everybody on the same page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then we understand there will be some fiscal note for the hand counting here, and that it may take some more time to certify the election, and I think that's somewhat regrettable, but we already know democracy is neither efficient nor cheap, but it's the best way we got, and I think it's very, very important to ensure fairness and accuracy at every level. And across the nation, there are questions raised about how to make sure that the electronic machines that we use more and more are accurate and fair, and doing an occasional spot check hand count, I think, is really essential to that process.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gardner. Laura, we'd asked the Division of Elections, do you have any comments or concerns on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, since we last met, we went through and researched 22 out of the 287 AccuVote precincts do not account for at least 5% of the ballots cast in the district, just so that you all are aware that even we do have AccuVote precincts that are not, that don't meet the 5% bar. And it, as, you know, this is just informational so that you all understand what that means.
So, on the that means that those precincts, 22% of the precincts could not be used for...
Less than 10% of the precincts that are, that would be machine count. Now, if you were to stretch this to touchscreen in 2006, there'll be a touchscreen in every precinct. So if the draw was random and that's how that was the machine you were testing, then you would, you know, every precinct would have at least one touchscreen. So that, again, just informational. 152 precincts in our state are hand count now. Representative Gardner spoke to the fiscal note. It's approximately $3,500.
How much?
3.5, very, very minimal, to hire an additional state review board just for as a hand count team, so the current state review board can act as they do presently, and then we would have a backup team that just did hand count verification. I would ask the committee for, instead of requiring us as a shall, to give us some room to may, so that we aren't, you know, bound to do this, but that we may utilize this to test on the, you know, on the side of proving the machines. This state in the last 5 years has had an incredible amount of recounts, and those AccuVotes have been, just as they're said, accurate. The Anchorage mayor's race, right on the money. Matsu Borough hand recounted because they weren't sure, and they were 5 or 6 votes off, I think. I mean, it's just an amazing process, our statewide recount. Again, it's a policy called by the legislature, but that I would just ask that, we have it as a may instead of a shall.
Okay, Representative Gatto, and then Representative Lynn.
Just curious, is it conceivable that there is some voting district that has nothing but precincts that are under the bar?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, no. Every district has at least one precinct, I think. Okay. I've just lost the number, but they'd all meet the bar. Every district has at least one precinct that would meet the bar for testing at 5%. So,
okay. Okay, Representative Lynn.
How much would this delay getting the final preliminary vote count, not the certified, but the election night count?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, it would not affect the election night count at all. It's during the state review process. There's the state, the numbers that you get on election night, and then the review boards in each of the regions meet, the absentee review board and the question review board. They conduct their review, and then it comes to the state review board. So this activity does not take place till the ballots reach the state review board.
And one more question, if I may.
Lynn.
What happens then if you find one precinct hand count that there's a significant error? Do you then have to recount every precinct in the state that has an automatic machine?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, this amendment says if there is a discrepancy of more than 1% between the results of the hand count under A3 of this section and the count certified by the election board, the director shall conduct a hand count of the ballots in the entire district. So no, not to the state, but to the district should there be found an error in the precincts. Another note is 1% can be just one vote in a lot of these precincts, so perhaps some leeway in a 3%, 5%. I mean, when we did the statewide recount, we implemented our own standards. You know, the test was 3. So if you were off 3 votes, regardless of what percentage that meant, if we were off 3, we hand counted again. So I think a 3% margin would be a reasonable.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
I kind of like the 1%, but it could have a double bar that says 1% but not less than 3 votes. Or
Representative Gatto, through the chair. But again, if we recount that whole district, that is going to delay, again, certification of election.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. 2 points, Mr. Chair. On the recount, the percentage amount, if the hand-counted precinct is at least 5% of the district, and then I wouldn't have a problem with actually making it or a certain number of votes, 1% or whichever is different, is greater. And in terms of whether it's a shall or a may, I think the whole point is that it should be shall, that what we want to do is have the greatest integrity we possibly can. And while I have every confidence in the Division of Elections across the nation, there are concerns about the possibility of wiring in or programming machines to count only a certain way on a certain date. And what we want to do is assure everyone that we are doing the best we can to make sure our elections are fair and honest. And to that end, the point is to make sure that we do spot check every district.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's say the large interior district that, and I don't know the number that Representative Salmon represents. And may I dialogue for a minute with Ms. Glaser?
Yes.
What in that district, is Fort Yukon the biggest precinct there? Is there more than one?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I am wondering why my districts aren't in the right number, in right order.
Well, it's not necessary to get into.
It's District 6 would be Representative Salmon's. They have 5 AccuVotes, Copper Center, Deltana, Kenny Lake, Nenana, and Toke.
So, okay, because this, I don't read the amendment as being limited to machines. It could be a hand-counted precinct with paper ballots, could it not?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, the amendment I have before me, that's correct.
And it would seem to me that the chance of a miscount is at least as great in a hand-counted precinct as with a machine, is it not?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, in fact, you'd probably find more discrepancy in hand count. There is a public concern about machines. But again, this state has proven in 5 or 6 recounts in the last 3 years that the AccuVote machines are on, and we do have discrepancies in hand count precincts.
I
currently is is resolved through the state chair, I mean, the state review board process. They, when they review the precinct register and the ballots, that's resolved at that time.
I am just wondering, and I've got to change my, the focus of my question to Representative Gardner.
Representative Grunberg.
Is there a reason why you have, that there would be a requirement that the precinct have at least 5% of the ballots? Because I would think that the it might be wise for the division to be able to select whichever precinct it wanted.
I think the point is not that it be selected, but that it be random and that it be representative of the district. And if it were a precinct that was just very tiny in a large district, it might not be representative of how the count is really going.
You mean having the bar here at one?
Yes.
So maybe we want to give the election division a little more discretion, rather.
And just make it a random selection of the precincts?
Yeah, that's what I would suggest.
That could be acceptable.
And secondly,
Representative Grunberg, follow up.
George, Mr. Ascott, and my staff and I were discussing yesterday the new Section 10 here, the State Ballot Counting Review Board, and Ms. Glazer. The current language, and I'm looking at this Section 10, it basically, as I understand it, means that the parties can, if they wish, have an appointed representative to watch the count. Is that not correct?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that's correct.
And that's at no cost to the state?
That's correct. They are there to observe, to ensure that the counts are going as...
Secondly, with a state ballot counting review board, that's quite different than the current situation, which is just if the Republican Party wants to observe the recount, they can send somebody. The state ballot counting review board is a whole body with bipartisan, and you basically, this would require you to convene that in each one of these random things.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I don't believe this changes our process, I mean our review. The State Review Board would be present and conducting their review. Simultaneously, hand count verifications would be taking place.
Would this mean that the only member of the party that could be present would be the person who was on the State Ballot Review Board?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, my first read of that would be that you are correct, that I can do this with the assistance and in the presence of the State Ballot Counting Review Board, period, would mean that the parties would not be have appointed representatives present as well.
So it would change the monitoring situation from now, which is sort of an ad hoc kind of a thing, to you'd have the board there at all times.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we always have the board there. All I think this would change is that while the board is present, other appointed members of the party could not be present. An example this time, in the House District 5 race, the Democratic Party sent a representative to watch the state review board conduct their review of House District 5. The way I understand this amendment, that they could, the Democratic Party could no longer do that.
Okay, Representative Gatto, then Gardner, then Lynn.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just historically, in the Matsu with 70,000 residents, we had a borough mayor election, which was decided by 6 votes. Upon recount, it was reduced to 5. So every single vote, so crucial. So my question is this: with the optical scanner, which is just a wonderful reader, if indeed it reads the circle with the dark smudge in it, is there a threshold that says, I'm not sure, the scanner is speaking, I'm not sure if this is a circle or an erasure, does it take that ballot and delete it for a person reading it, or does it simply disregard it as unreadable and simply give no vote?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the AccuVotes, if the mark is light, will bring it back because it's considered an undervote. So the person then is asked, that's part of the Help America Vote Act as well.
Oh, I see.
That the voter then is asked, you know, do you know that you haven't marked all the ballots? Yes, then it goes through. We're taught to be discreet about that because there are often, when you see the vote totals, you'll see a discrepancy between the amount of Alaskans that voted for president versus the amount that voted for U.S. Senate. Some people choose not to vote in certain races. But yes, there is a discrepancy in the reading of the AccuVote. It's you know, voters are instructed and there are signs inside in polling booths to tell them how to make a mark, but often they do not. We found that in the statewide recount, people write across, they don't mark, they put a dot, they don't do anything. So that then it becomes, you know, a human call on the intent of the voter.
And just Laura, this amendment wouldn't have anything to do with that situation where you had a 5-vote discrepancy, right? Because you would have an automatic recount.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. So, and that bar is at 0.5% of the number of votes in the district. Okay. Follow up on that point?
Quickly, the recount is done exactly the way the count was done using the scanner. Is that correct?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, and random hand counts. We implemented random hand counts as well.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
A few moments ago, I thought I heard somebody say that somebody might purposely tamper with one of these machines to affect the outcome in favor of one candidate or another. And how difficult would that be for a person to go in and doctor a machine so that candidate A was favored over candidate B? Is this a real concern?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, there is a group called Black Box Voting that perpetuates that idea that it could be done. It is the tampering in our state. We have one individual who programs our machines. The person is not a vendor. In some states, it's the vendor that does a programming of an election. We do not. You have a protected state employee who programs the machines for the ballots. The concern is that could a vendor put something in the software that affected the votes? And there's the debate is just as strong on either side.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
It is actually theoretically possible. They call it a backdoor, that it can be programmed to favor the first candidate or in any way you want. I mean, it is possible to do it. Now, there's no evidence it's been done in this state, but the point of the spot checking is to guard against that possibility someday, sometime. Regarding the question about the review, state review counting board, I just want to emphasize the board already exists, it's already working, and it's already convened, and it's appointed. This amendment does not address in any way whether there can be other people watching or not watching. It simply says that the count is done in the presence of the review board. But it doesn't mean that others can't be there, too.
Right. You know, we can do whatever. We've had a request for a may instead of a shall. Personally, you know, I think that the review board and division of election policies have, you know, adequately shown that they are sampling the election, that they are reviewing those. I think putting in this procedure is a complication that I'm not willing to impose upon the division for a problem that I don't think we have. But that's going to be the view of the committee. Up to the committee as to whether they want to do that, but that's just my own thought at this time. I mean, if we had a problem that we were trying to address, but it seems like we're trying to address a problem that we
don't have,
but that we don't have. So, does anyone wish to make an amendment to this amendment? We had a request from the Division of Elections for a may instead of a shall. Is that something that is being considered on this amendment or not?
So move that.
Where is that one?
That is the director shall.
Okay, line 4?
Yeah, that'd be line 4, the last word.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomer.
There are shalls several places in this thing, on line 4 and on line 10.
Mr. Chair.
And then on line 21 and 22.
Representative Gardner.
If we changed it, the bill from shall to may, the entire bill's not needed, because currently the director can do this anytime she wants, and that's appropriate. But the point of this bill is that it shall be done to assure the public that we do everything we possibly can to be sure that our election process is fair.
Representative Grunberg.
I am having some of the same problems on the merits. But I do see a potential issue here. Is it the chair's intention to move the bill out today?
If we can get there, it would be lovely, because we have bills on both sides, and we've done a lot of work in here on this. Move as long as quickly as we can.
The reason I was going to say is the bill goes to Judiciary next, and I will commit something I haven't said to you, Representative Gardner, to work with you and the division to see what we can do to address your concerns. And I was going to say, if you weren't going to move it today, then I would work with you over the weekend on it, or in Judiciary or whatever. I've thought about it, but not enough.
Well, I think we really need to get along with some of the amendments here. And so we've got an objection to that idea from Representative Gardner. Does anyone wish to offer that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'd offer the amendment to change. I'm not so sure about the other lines that were pointed out, but definitely in line 4, from shall to may.
I'm going to.
Okay. Representative Gruner, objection?
Yeah, because I'm not sure that's the right shall. I think that would screw up other things in the law, frankly. I would urge the member, if you're going to make that amendment, not to make it there, and I'd ask Ms. Glazer, where should it be made?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, we don't propose to want to change anything that we've been doing for years and years in the division. So I believe it'd be more conceptual, but you know that we already do the review ballot counting by the director shall include only a review of precinct registers, tallies, and ballots cast, a review of absentee and question ballots subscribed as law. And then my suggestion would be, and the director may include a hand count of ballots.
Jim, that's where it's.
That's off my off my head.
That'd be all right.
So we are talking about line 10.
No, line 14.
Or line 14.
And may include.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gardner.
I have a question for Ms. Glazer. Can you not currently, under current regulations, hand count any ballot, any district you wish?
Yes, ma'am.
So what would be the point of this registration, this regulation, if we?
May include.
If you can already do that, how would this change your current?
It would not change our current. That's Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Just if I may make sure I've got this right.
Okay.
I think that the amendment to the amendment by Representative Elkins should be on 14, after the paren 3 close paren, and may include a hand count. Isn't that right, Ms. Glazer?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I believe that would work.
Okay. we have an amendment to add the words and may include on line 14 after paren 3. Do I have an objection?
Objection.
Okay, we have an objection. And Representative Lynn?
Well, that, I guess, answered it, because if this doesn't change anything but what we have now, it seems to be irrelevant whether we do it or not do it, but that would be our. If we take a vote on it.
And Representative Gatto, were you going to make the same point?
Close enough, I'll just keep the objection in place.
Okay, so the objection is in place, and we're voting on whether to This is amendment number 3, I believe, isn't it?
No, it's an amendment.
No, amendment to the amendment. That's right. Number 1 to the amendment, number 2. Let's see, can we get a roll call vote, please?
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye. Yes.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Ramros? Not present. Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Chair Seaton?
No.
5 nay, 1 yay.
Okay, so now we have before us the amendment. Is there a any further discussion or amendment to the amendment?
This is the amendment.
Yes. This is amendment number 2. This is Representative Gardner's amendment requiring the hand counting of randomly selected precincts. Okay, seeing no further, is there any further discussion? No further discussion. Lori, would you call roll, please?
Amendment 2, Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Lynn?
Pass.
Representative Ramos, not present. Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Chair Seaton?
No.
4 nay, 2 yay.
Okay, so Representative, or Amendment number 2 has failed to pass. Now we have, CS. Would you move the CS, Representative Groomer?
Yeah, just 1 half.
Or Representative Gatto, would you?
I will just say that my commitment stands with what I've said. Okay, I would move the adoption of the F version of CS for House Bill 94, State Affairs. It's 211, and the members will note we're going backwards in the alphabet here. For summarizing.
Is that 2.5?
Drafters do that.
It's this one, 211.05. No, it's not an amendment, it's CS. We have to do it. And if somebody would object, I'll explain the difference.
I'll object.
Mr. Chair, the what this does, first of all, is it includes the Gatto amendments, which were at least the number of here we go. It's okay. If you take a look on page 19, line 7, 19, line 8, and 19, line 12, at least 5 copies, at least 1 copy. That's in section 43, a little bit earlier. It has the at least language. I think it was in section 26. If I'm not mistaken. Yes, section 26 on page 12, lines 20 and 21.
Okay, Representative Grimberg, would you clarify what you're looking at?
I'm looking at the F version, the new language that's in. Mr. Flora, by the way, sent around a little packet as to what was included in here.
Okay, so this is the CS that you're looking at, and everybody should note that you have a package of amendments, and on those amendments, down at the bottom, you will see if they say in CS, that means those amendments were combined into CS version F, which we have before us for consideration right now.
Then, in addition, on page 19, line 31, the word forms is added.
Did everybody find where we are now?
He's going to get to an amendment.
Okay.
He's going to get it.
Just a minute. We don't have an amendment package here. We'll take a brief at ease. bring the committee back to order as we can. And what we have before us right now is we have a motion to adopt committee substitute for HB 94 version F. And that has incorporated a number of amendments, and Representative Gruenberg, who worked with the Division of Election, and my staff is going through those amendments and explaining what has been adopted into the CS. So would you continue?
The member, thank you, Mr. Chair. The member should have two things. First is this F version that is 211.05, and Representative Ramros, we're going backwards alphabetically from the G to the F, but this is the motion to adopt this.
Yes, sir.
And the all everything that's in here is in this little packet that has a Louis Flora label on it. And what we did...
What's the Louis Flora label?
This is exactly what was adopted and melded into the F version. There's the Gatto at least stuff. We've eliminated the effective date clause, which was G7. There was no reason for an effective date clause. I'm paraphrasing and moving fast through what Ms. Glazer and I talked about. The word forms was just omitted. It was a misprint. And technically, if the members would look on I'm looking at the very last page of the Flora packet here. It's G8, and you'll look and you'll find it on page 19. It's actually on line 29. And that phrase, except that the director may suspend the monthly verifications on or after June 1 and before November 30 of a general election year. The reason that was put in is because what the Division of Elections does, Mr. Chair, is for these parties that are just about at the edge of whether they qualify as political parties numerically, they have a certain number of registered voters, they check them every month, and they go up or down to see whether they're going to qualify. And the question is whether they qualify on the June 1st, May 31 deadline. You'll see on line 18, the key date is May 31. And there's no need to do these monthly verifications between June 1st and the date of the election because they're set in stone for that election as of May 31.
And we discussed this when we adopted this.
Another bulletin.
So. Is there anyone that has any problems with those that doesn't understand any of the things that we've incorporated into the CS? If not, I'll remove my objection, and we now have before the committee version F. And before we go on, let's see, what amendment number will be on the First Amendment now because it's to the F version? Question, Representative Gruenberg, did the CS incorporate all of the amendments that we had adopted to the G version?
Yes, sir. The only ones we had adopted were the Gatto Amendment number 1, the at least.
Thank you. And we dealt with amendment number, the other amendment that was offered earlier today in the G version. Before we go forward any further, I would like to offer an amendment. And that is on
We've adopted the
F version. On page 19, line 18, to strike the word first, just so we can take care of that. We discussed it. It's on page 19 of the F version, line 18, the word first election year. So it would just read May 31st of the election year. Because we could have a party that is certified and then decertified and then recertifies again, and yet this just gives us a conundrum. So
this is amendment 3.
This is amendment number 1 to the F version.
Oh, okay.
Do I hear any objections to amendment number 1? Seeing no objections, amendment number 1, striking the word first. On page 19, line 18 is adopted. Okay. Proceeding. We have an amendment package that is labeled I think that's...
Laura,
do you have a suggestion in which way, which amendments you want to take up first on these?
Mr. Chairman,
I'm prepared to answer
every question.
Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Possibly we could take up Representative Ledoux's amendment.
Is Representative Ledoux's, is...
I'm going to do that for her, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Ramos, would you care to offer an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer amendment number 2, the F version.
And that is labeled F.5, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, F.5 in the upper right-hand corner. Just make sure everybody has the right one, and that's delete a U.S. citizen. That's the amendment we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, for the benefit of the committee, would you like me to, I'm doing this as a courtesy for Representative Ledoux. May I explain to the committee the...
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Rammer.
Ledoux's here.
Unless Representative Ledoux would like to come up and...
Yes, that's fine.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. I didn't see that you were here. My apologies, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
We offered it. Yeah, the amendment was offered. Do I have an objection?
This is your answer.
Yes, I'm objecting for the purpose of discussion.
Fine. We have an objection. Representative Lou.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for allowing me the opportunity to testify and to explain this amendment. Currently, the statute reads for absentee voters, there's a witness requirement. And there's a witness requirement if you're voting by mail of two persons over the age of 18 years old. The Division of Elections has noted a problem with the two witness requirement because it disenfranchises, to a certain extent, people in remote locations in Alaska who aren't able to locate two witnesses. So they've changed it in their proposed amendment to one witness. But at the same time that they've reduced the number of witnesses, they've added on, at least for voting by mail, the additional requirement that one witness be a United States citizen. And that has the effect, I believe, of disenfranchising a number of people who are attempting to vote overseas. In my district alone, I don't have the exact figures, but I believe that there were somewhere between 35 and 50 people who voted in the last election from overseas, from anywheres, Nicaragua, Greece, Mexico, the Philippines, Israel. For some of those people, it would have been difficult to locate even one United States citizen. Take, for example, my daughter, who was, hosteling around and in some pretty remote locations. So I like the idea of reducing the number of witnesses, but I don't want to add that additional hurdle of making that witness a United States citizen. Also, for faxed voting, the former requirement, there was an inconsistency in the statute as it reads now between the requirements for by mail voters and by faxed voters. And if you were voting by fax, you did need to have it witnessed by two United States citizens. So we're suggesting, we're asking this committee to have an amendment that for both mail and fax, that either it be reduced to one person over the age of 18 years old for both mail or fax, or I'd actually think that it might be preferable to simply eliminate the witness requirements altogether. There's a Federal Voting Assistance Act program geared to individuals either residing overseas, traveling overseas, or military people overseas. And that Federal Voter Assistance Program has suggested, and I believe you've got this in some of the information we gave you, that Alaska totally eliminate the witness requirement for overseas voting. And it's indicated that 36 other states or territories have done so. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ledoux. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Groomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a very interesting conversation last night, Christine and Representative Ledoux and Peter and myself, and we're giving out the letter that she is referring to from the Voter Assistance Project that says 36 states have eliminated the requirement of witnessing entirely. And, Mr. Chair, I have here an amendment to do that, and I would ask if it would we can consider these side by side. This would be an amendment, a substitute for amendment number, whatever this is, number two, and it would eliminate the witness requirements entirely. And see if Representative Ledoux would prefer to proceed with her or to use this, but let the people see the choice here.
Well, I think we'll hold that for a little bit. We'll,
oh, okay.
We're going to deal with this subject first. Are there, but every, thank you for letting everybody know that, that there is a
I'll
proposal to eliminate all witnesses entirely. So that's, if that's an option that people can maintain, because that will be coming forward. Does anyone else have a question for Representative Ledoux? Okay.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah. Representative Gutter.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think the concern here was people traveling in a foreign country could not find U.S. citizens. They could be traveling alone. They could be in Peace Corps. They could be on some sort of mission, covert mission. I don't know. It may be hard to find U.S. citizens. And but they'd like to vote. But if they're actually residing in the USA, it wouldn't seem to be a very high bar to find one person that is a U.S. citizen. So I guess your intent was to not disenfranchise people who happen to be visiting Okinawa on election day or something like that. And so do you still feel that a U.S. citizen or a witness that must be a U.S. citizen in this country shouldn't be one of the bars that we have to meet? Or were you really focusing on people who truly were in an awkward geographical location that made it difficult? Or is that too long a question?
It's not too long of a question, Representative Gatto, through the chair. I'm really focusing on the people who are outside of the country, although my concern is that if you have a different set of requirements for people outside of the country, as opposed to people inside of the country, that might make it more difficult for the Division of Elections to administer. But my concern is for those who are outside of this country.
Does anyone else have any follow-up? Representative Gatto.
And I'm going to ask Ms. Glazier this.
Well, we'll bring her up okay. in a minute, but if you have any more questions for Representative Ledoux.
No.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. Laura, would you come back up, please? I've given up saying, giving your last name, because I always put representative in front of it, so it's
Laura is
it's
fine,
going to be Laura.
Chairman.
Thank you. Would you, Representative Gatto has a question.
If you were to receive in the mail an absentee ballot and it asked for a U.S. signature and the person had simply written in there N/A, how would you treat that ballot that you just received?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, you're asking in a signature line somebody just put N/A?
For the witness.
That ballot would not be counted. Representative Gatto, through the chair.
Laura, does the Division of Elections have the administration have a position on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I did review all the amendments and the CS with the Lieutenant Governor, and the Lieutenant Governor has a problem with dropping the bar of U.S. citizens. This is a U.S. election. There are U.S. citizens who are voting. I know Annette Kreitzer, the Chief of Staff for the Lieutenant Governor, is here. I know she's had more extensive conversations with him. As you know, I represent the division, but I'm obligated to tell you what my boss thinks as well, and he is opposed to dropping the bar. Representative Gatto raised a good question, which is this current, what you're amending, is our absentee by-mail program for everyone in the United States, whether they're traveling overseas or whether they live here in Alaska. And so removing the U.S. citizen bar from someone who lives in the United States may be overarching. Additionally, the question that they do it in 36 states, I moved here because we don't do it like they do it everywhere else. So I don't really just follow that just because they do it somewhere else that should be, that we should change our laws. Other states have a great deal of problems with fraud. They've had problems with their election totals. And I can't say that's related to the witnessing requirement, but I can also say that Alaska's always been an A-plus state before I got here, and I'm sure, I hope, after I leave, and as far as its voting and what we do to ensure that every vote counts. So.
Thank you, Laura. The question is not whether we're lowering a bar, but we're establishing a new bar, I believe, because on the absentee by mail does not require the witness of a U.S. citizen currently. That's only on the
correct.
Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's so correct. That you're lowering the bar in the facts.
In the facts.
The by facts section, the 1520.066.
That's right, but we are raising
right.
the bar on the
you're correct.
Ballots by mail. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the members would look at the letter from Paul Mendez, who's with the Federal Voting Assistance Program. Ms. Glazer, through the chair, are you familiar with the Federal Voting Assistance Program?
Representative Grunberg, yes, sir.
What is that?
It's an organization that assists those who vote overseas, who vote military, that we complete surveys with them.
Is it through the federal government?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that's my Federal Voting Assistance Program.
That's my question. Is it a federal? Is it under the federal government? Is it a federal program?
Representative Grunberg, I am not certain.
Okay. Do you have a copy of the letter from Paul Mendez?
Yes, sir.
Okay. He states and recommends that that the witnessing requirement be eliminated. He gives sample language here, and I have basically had that sample language drafted in an amendment that I plan to offer as an alternative to this, because in most states, the three-quarters of the states, have eliminated this witnessing requirement entirely, largely for the reasons that have been expressed in this committee. If you have somebody sign, the signature is often illegible. You can't tell who did it. It's just equally susceptible to fraud as anything else. If you're going to have a fraudulent ballot, you're going to have a fraudulent witness. It doesn't provide any protection at all. What about just simplifying your life and eliminating witness requirements entirely?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I didn't take this job to make my life simple. I have made a critical error in career choices. But to remove the witness requirement, you're correct. It doesn't. We don't identify those signatures. All of those things are true. However, those people take an oath. as a witness. The voter takes an oath that they are a U.S. citizen, or in fact, and as far as facts, if it's a absentee by mail, you know that, and it goes through, as you know, in the law. The voter is not asked; they also have to sign that they didn't find a notary, that they didn't find a uniformed officer, that they take an oath that this witnessing is the second option. The first option, the legislature meant for there to be a high bar, a notary, a uniformed officer, an official. And on the absentee ballot envelope, it says, you know, the voter signs that I cannot find a qualified official, I've opted for two witnesses.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up with one question.
Yes, but I want to make sure that we're on the amendment before us, not on an amendment that may be offered later.
I see. Well, just to follow up with one thing she said, if
that's
I could.
That's right. Representative Groomer.
If the voter herself takes this oath under penalty of perjury, which is a Class C felony, that's pretty stiff penalty for lying, is it not?
Representative Groomberg, through the chair, I believe so.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gardner, and then Representative Lynn.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Why do we have a different bar for mail versus fax? As I understand it, that you don't have to have a witness for fax, but you do by mail. What's the difference?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I know that the by fax option of voting was created recently in the legislature. Then Representative Terry Martin, I'm sure Representative Groenberg remembers, the idea of fax voting initially was for our men and women who serve in the military and overseas. It has extended in this last year where people here in Juneau have chosen to vote by fax. They don't go to their polling place, they vote by fax. But I believe, though I haven't done the research and the minutes, that he set that bar at two U.S. citizens. That had happened. It's different right now than it is for the by-mail program.
Yeah, just for clarification,
but why?
By fax, you have to have two U.S. citizens. By the vote that comes in by mail has one witness. So you have two U.S. citizen witnesses for voting by fax and electronically, and you have one witness in the vote by mail.
That's my question, sir. Why do we have two or one? What's the difference? Why do you want to have a higher bar than the other?
Well, I think the concern probably was that electronic voting was something that could we wanted to make sure that we didn't get fraudulent and didn't get problems. I wasn't here at that time, but I mean, understanding my reasoning would be, okay, we're opening an elections process to something that's coming over the wires, and we want to make sure that we're not getting tampering, we're not getting, you know, we get spam email all the time. And so I think that was the thinking of it, but I wasn't here at the time. Representative Gutter.
Just a comment. We keep getting email messages that say undeliverable, and it's coming from a person who I never sent anything to.
Yeah,
and somebody's gotten your email list. I have a concern also about email and fax and things like that, that electronically all of us are pretty much amateurs here. Pros can really do amazing things, so that's my concern.
Okay, Representative Rammer. Again, let's make sure that we're all considering Amendment Number 2, which is before us. Representative Rammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Laura, is it fair to say, if I want to crystallize this issue, that I've got two issues here? One is, the intent that I've seen in HB 94, which is to maintain the lowest possible common denominator for people to participate in the election process. And on the other hand, your concern is the fraud dynamic that could come into it. Is that a fair way to assess this amendment?
Representative Ramos through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on amendment number two to version F? And this amendment would delete person of the U.S. citizen and leave it as an individual. It deletes the U.S. citizen requirement from the reduction from 2 to 1. Yes, Representative Groomer.
I'm going to support the amendment, but I'm going to then, one way or the other, at some point, and I'll be talking to the members of the committee, hopefully, offer an amendment that would eliminate the witnessing requirement entirely.
That's fine. You can do that at that time. Okay, no other discussion. Lori, would you call the roll?
I can't. Oh,
yes. We did have an objection, yes.
Amendment 2 to Bertram F. Representative
Lynn. Yes.
Representative Brammer.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg?
Yes.
Representative
Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Chair C?
No.
5-2,
yay. And so Amendment 2 has passed. Now we are on to Amendment number... I'd like the committee to go to the back of your amendment package, and Representative Samuels, would you like to come forward? And this would be F.1.
Where is F going?
Here's F.1 here.
Do we have a copy of that?
Section 17.
Is it F.1? That's, I think, the second amendment.
Does somebody follow up?
Would you, or what's happening? Oh, yeah, it's in that amendment package.
Can we do that?
Okay, let's go to F2. Would the committee go to F2?
Help me find it here.
You got so much paperwork up here that in so many different versions. Sure that everybody has this amendment. Representative Elkin and Ramirez, do you have F2?
Yes, sir, I have F2.
I don't have.
Representative Elkins, then you have to.
It should be at the very back of that amendment package that has that starts with the G.1.
G2.
The package that starts with G.1.
My God.
Representative Grunberg, would you offer?
And this, what number is this?
This will be amendment number 3.
Amendment number 3. Now we're offering F2.
Yes.
For the purposes of discussion, I will offer amendment number 3, which is the F2.
And for discussion, I'll object. Representative Samuels,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a casual conversation I had with Laura Glazer, I pointed out a couple of problems that I saw in the previous election cycle in my hometown. And the first one dealt with the constitutional requirements for age limits for House is 21 and for state Senate is 25 and for the governor, lieutenant governor is 30. But there was an instance where the candidate would not have been of age to serve but could possibly have won the election. And if it's a day, you might think it's no problem if it's a day, or if it's a week, you get sworn in a week later. And my concern was, what if it were a year, or what if it were 2 months and you missed half the session, and that person actually won the election, and then that district was out without representation because he couldn't serve constitutionally, so he couldn't be sworn in. So this simply, to me, clarifies that you have to be 21 on the first day of the session. You can run, but your birthday has to be before the first day of the session or to be elected governor, and by statute, you have to be the required age of 30 before the day you get sworn in December. And that's on page 2 of the amendment.
it spells it out. So the Constitution says you have to be 21, 25, or 30 to serve, and the statute would just say you have to be there 21, 25, or 30 for the entire term, basically what it would say.
Okay, thank you. So what this is doing is clarifying that the age requirements have to be met on a certain day, and that is the date at which you would be sworn into office.
The date that the legislature convenes into office. Because you could potentially get elected and have your birthday in the summertime and miss the entire session, and then that district is without representation. And I think the courts would be very reticent to throw out an election, but then you get into a big gray area.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Representative Samuels, Representative Gruenberg, and then Representative Gatto.
Two things. When I saw this last night, I talked to Catherine Kurtz, the legal counsel, about this. I wasn't sure what the purpose of this was, and I noticed that it didn't include the federal offices in here, the U.S. Senator and U.S. Representative. It only includes the state offices. That's one problem I have. The second problem I have is, if the intent of it is to state that you must be 21, let's say, on the first day of the session, I'm not sure that that's constitutional. That may be adding a requirement to the, I think it's Article 4, Section 1. I'd like a legal opinion on whether that is constitutional, whether we can deny a person the right to serve and run and the people a right to elect him or her if they're going to be even one day late.
Through the chair, the Constitution says you have to be 21. The Constitution says that you have to be 21. I said the courts aren't going to throw an election out, and yet you can't have the non-representation, so it's...
So, Representative Samuels, what the intent of this amendment is to say that since you are precluded from serving until you're 21, and if you were elected,
you can't be certified to run unless you're going to meet the constitutional requirements.
Right. Okay. Let's see. Representative Goddard, did you have a question?
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. What about appointed positions? This age requirement. Can the governor appoint someone 20 years old and still satisfy the amendment?
Through the chair, you cannot serve if you are not 21, 25, or 30. Okay. That's in the Constitution.
Anyone else have a question for Representative Samuels? Follow-up, Representative Gatto.
Just a follow-up, and I guess I don't know what the language is, but I know the first regular session is defined in statute as calculated.
Through the chair, and we can get the exact verbiage, but it depends if it's a gubernatorial election year or not. It delays by a week. Two years ago in 02, we started a week or 10 days later than we started this session, but the language of the amendment would say whenever the legislature convenes, right after the election, not a special session because that would be the previous legislature, that you have to have turned 21 so that you can serve.
Okay, follow up, Representative Gatto.
The reason I was interested in if you would consider, instead of the words the first day of the first regular session, to consider what the statutory language is, because I'm not sure whether snowstorms or so can delay the session by a couple of days, and then someone would say, hey, I would have qualified because they didn't meet till Tuesday. And on Tuesday, I would have been qualified and be able to make an argument.
Representative Samuel.
Through the chair, we're talking about being able to be certified to run. So the decision will have been made the previous June before the January. If you're not going to turn 21 by the day, and we know which day right now, we can tell what day in 2006 the legislature is going to convene. It's somewhere in this book. Somewhere in a book in this room is the date the legislature in 2006 is going to convene. So if you're not 21, the amendment will say if you're not 21 by the day that we're scheduled to convene.
Scheduled. That's the key.
Then the Division of Elections cannot certify you to run because you wouldn't be eligible to serve, and you're doing a disservice to the constituency.
Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Have you had a legal opinion prepared on this issue?
Through the chair, I thought it was a common sense amendment, to tell you the truth. And I mean, no disrespect, Representative Grunberg. I saw a problem at the recent election, and I extrapolated, what if it had been a year, not a week?
The reason I'm saying is, I through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
I just looked. The language is in Article 2, Section 2. And let me read it. It's very short, if I may.
Yes, you may.
It's called Member's Qualification. A member of the legislature shall be a qualified voter who has been a resident of the Alaska for at least 3 years and of the district from which elected for at least 1 year immediately preceding his filing for office. And then this is the second sentence, and this is the operative sentence, folks. A senator shall be at least 25 years of age and a representative at least 21 years of age, period. It doesn't say when. There are a couple of opinions of Attorney General, though, in the cash line, and I'm not familiar with these. But what it says, according to the notes here, the state legislature may not change the qualifications for a public office where the state constitution has set forth the qualifications and the constitution has not specifically provided that the legislature has the power to change or add to the qualifications. That's from 1963, opinion of the Attorney General, number 6. And so there's another opinion.
Representative Grunberg, I think that what you're talking about would be definitely true if we said, oh, the legislature is going to say you can't run for election until you're 21.
That's what we're saying here.
No, this is saying that you have to follow the Constitution. You can't serve until you're 21. If you won't be 21 on the day of that you have to start serving, then you can't run for election. This is not saying that you have to be 21 before you can file for election. It says that if you cannot file for election and run unless you will be 21 on the day in which you would have to start serving, which is exactly clarifying what the Constitution is saying, is you can't be a representative until you're 21. And yet if you elected somebody who isn't 21 until March, he couldn't serve in the legislature. So that district would be without representation from January through March.
There's another attorney. I was about to read a second opinion. May I just read the paragraph there?
Sure.
Okay. And this is from another opinion, 1960 opinion of the Attorney General. Bills passed by the Senate during a period of service in that body of a senator who was at the time less than 25 years of age were valid. So apparently it happened that somebody has actually served who wasn't of that age. And I'm just concerned that this would appear to chill the right of a candidate to run who was not going to be 21 or 25 or 30 for a few days later. And I have constitutional problems with it.
Representative Lynn.
Well, I think we're talking about a unfortunate situation that happened in this last election cycle, and this has got to be fixed, because quite frankly, what happened previously, and I don't ever want to see it happen again, this was not fair to the opponent. It would not be fair to the opponent in a situation like this. It's certainly not even fair to the candidate himself, and it's certainly not fair to the voters to have a situation in which somebody is not qualified to serve. It just needs to be fixed. Common sense tells us that.
Division of Elections, Laura, does the division have any comment on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, everybody knows it was part of in the media about the problem about certifying a candidate and the date of certification. This certainly would be a bright line for the division to follow when certifying candidates, because we can check the date of birth. We can. It is set in statute when session begins, when a governor is sworn in. All of those things can be determined by the Division of Elections by June 1st on the filing day to certify a candidate to be placed on the ballot. So it, we are able to do that, and it certainly would be a bright line for us to follow.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have any further questions? Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Glazer, a person can't file for office until they file their declaration of candidacy, right?
Correct.
And under this amendment, they couldn't file their declaration of candidacy unless they certified that they would be 21 on the date the legislature convened. Is that not correct?
That's my understanding.
So the result of that would mean that nobody could run who was not 21 on the date that the legislature convened. Is that not correct?
Representative Gruenberg, that's correct. You, at the time of certification for the candidate, if the candidate was to sign and say that they would be 21 on the day, on the first day of the legislature, just fold the language up, then they could not be placed on the ballot.
So that would, in effect, require candidates to meet the age requirements on the first day of the session, and my concern is whether that's constitutional.
And that'll just be everybody's call on this, is whether you think the Constitution requiring you to be 21 to serve means you have to be 21 to serve, or you don't have to be 21 to serve. So anyway, if there's no other discussion on this amendment, we had an objection? Yeah, Representative Gardner?
Well, I just have a question about language, which is the point about if somebody, say, is not certified to run because they're not going to be 21 until maybe 3 days later and there's a snowstorm and the language says the date that they'd be sworn in, and that's kind of a movable date. So I think we need to add something along the lines of the scheduled date or the
regularly
scheduled. Yes, the regularly scheduled date in case it changes.
You know, I think if you look at the wording on page 2, lines 6, it says 21 years of age on the first day of the first regular session of the legislature convened. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but that could change, couldn't it?
Versus regular session.
It's not, it's in statute, or it's in the, yes, Representative Sammons.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the decision on whether or not the candidate would be eligible to run is going to be made the previous summer.
Exactly.
So point. If the start of the session is January 10th, he'll know the previous June whether he'll be 21 on the 10th of January. It doesn't matter if we actually start till the 13th or the 15th or the 30th. I mean, if there's a earthquake or whatever happens, it doesn't matter because he will have been certified or not certified to run the previous summer.
Representative Gatto.
But in order for the Division of Elections to determine whether that person is eligible to run, according to this, they would have to know ahead of time what the first day of the first regular session would be. And that's an impossible bar. All they could do is say, I know what the schedule is.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that that's a good point, and scheduled first day would...
Scheduled day.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
Mr. Chair.
Okay, and Representative Gatto, are you operating that as a conceptual amendment for scheduled on line 6? Before first day, scheduled first day?
Yes.
Affirmative.
Okay, so Representative Gatto has offered amendment number 3. Amendment. Oh, no, this is amendment to the amendment. This is amendment to amendment number 3, amendment number 1 to amendment 3, inserting schedule before first day on page 2, line 6, conceptually.
And then all the way through the amendment.
And yes, and through the amendment, conforming. Representative Samuels, do you have any problems with that?
Nope.
As a sponsor? Does anyone else have any objection to that? Yes,
Representative. No, not to the amendment. Okay. To the amendment. Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we have adopted the amendment, number 1 to the amendment. Yes.
Just so it's clear why I have such concerns about this, I believe that it's just, we'd have to really look at the intent of the framers in that sentence. I could see some of them, or it's possible that they intended that the person meet the age requirement on the first day of the session. It's equally, at least equally possible, that they intended that the person meet the requirements at the time they're sworn in, so that if a person were a few days late in their birthday, they would just delay being sworn in, and a person would have a right to run, the voters would have a right to elect. I think that the situation must have arisen elsewhere. I'm believing that there was, in the U.S. Senate, a situation where either Ted Kennedy or Joe Biden was slightly lower than the age when they were elected, and they had to be sworn in a week or two late.
Okay, thank you for that, Representative Grunberg. Any other discussion on this amendment? Okay, we did have an objection.
I do.
We do have an objection. Lori, would you read the roll?
Amendment 3, version F, as amended. Representative Ramirez?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg?
No.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Chair Seaton?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And now we are on the amendment labeled F1. And just for everybody's understanding, we're going to take amendment F1, and then we're going to put this to the bottom of our pile for a few minutes and take up the next bill. Representative Grunberg, would you?
Sure. We're taking up F1.
F1.
And that is now to be labeled Amendment 4, and
four.
I would move F1.
And I'll object for discussion. Representative Samuels, would you?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's another situation I saw in my hometown that I had the conversation with Ms. Glazer about. The voter registration, the proof of candidacy for a one-year residency within the district, and to tell you the truth, you and I had this conversation before, if this got to the heart of what I was looking at, and if it does not, then I'll be happy to take the amendment to the next committee, that's fine. But the problem that I saw was that the proof of residency, there is no burden of proof on a candidate, even if they're not registered to vote. So if you're not registered, let's say you're registered to vote for a month in a district, and you file to run for office, let's say you're registered in May sometime, you file to run for office on the 1st of June, there should be some burden of proof for you on the year residency. The voting record, or the voting registered to vote in the district, I think is a good bar, very low bar. If you're registered to vote for a year, that's fine. You can prove the residency. And if you're not registered to vote, that's fine. But now the burden should go on to you to prove it. And the way that the current system works now, if I'm running against you in a particular election and I've only registered to vote for a month, you have 10 days to complain about my residency. And if you don't complain, or somebody, if a complaint is not filed, you don't have to do it. But if a complaint isn't filed, then the residency issue becomes a non-issue for the Division of Elections. Whether or not you were in town, whether or not anything happened or nobody paid attention, and there should be some bar. If you're not registered to vote for the year, you should have to prove that you're a resident of the district for a year. And I don't know, I didn't look through this amendment. I spent more time looking at the other amendment. If that's not what this, if it doesn't get to where I want it to get to, then I'd be happy not to do that. But I think that if I'm only registered for a month in my district, I can still run, I can still file, but I now have to prove. I've got to find some receipts or a rental slip or a tax payment or something to prove I was in the district, not put it on somebody to file the complaint and put it a little bit on the division to show some low burden, some low threshold that you're actually a resident of the district. And it stops, you know, people move around a block here and a block there, you know, the gamesmanship that sometimes goes on, and trying to have some threshold there. That's what the amendment is for.
Okay, appreciate the purpose of the amendment. Do we have any questions for Representative Samuels? Yes, Representative Gatto.
I hate to be such a scotch, but this term that the candidate is registered to vote in that district, I'm kind of curious, the word legally and currently maybe need to be inserted there so that you can be registered, but it could be a register that's challengeable, and you can simply argue that, hey, I'm registered. And I'd say, well, you're illegally registered. You never have lived here, even though you got your registration accidentally or through some error or something like that.
Maybe we can have the Division of Elections address that issue for us on registration and what does registration prove?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, your question is that just saying that the candidate is registered to vote, is that sufficient?
Mm-hmm.
The division believes that it's sufficient. The registration laws are currently set out and in place in what a qualified voter is, which also is a bar for a candidate. I don't know about an illegally obtained registration. When we check that they're a registered voter, they're in the database. There's a microfiche of the actual registration form. All your voter history is kept by the Division of Elections. I think this language is sufficient.
Laura, I have a question. The intent, as I understand it, of this is to say that basically there's a presumption if you were registered voter in the district for a year, then the presumption is you're a legal resident and you can run. As I understand what the intent of this is, if your registration is only for 6 months, it's not meant to preclude that you can run in that district. It just means that you have to come into the Division of Elections and show that you were a resident of the district by some other means for a full year. Now, I have a question with the way this is in here, and that the candidate is registered to vote in the district, whether that accomplishes the intent of what was coming forward. That is, you were registered for a year, and that's a that satisfies the presumption. If not, then you need to supply some other information. Do you, as the Division of Elections, feel that this wording in this place gets to the intent of the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, this may be a first step, and I'm not blindsiding Representative Samuels. We got this last night. I would say that I don't know whether we need additional language that then sets forth the next step, which is should the candidate not be registered in the district, then the candidate shall provide to the division. I don't know enough about, and Representative Gruenberg may know more, as far as whether I could set that out in regulation or whether it needs to be set out in statute as well. But if we the division can set that out in regulation, we could certainly go about it in that manner and say that should a candidate not be registered to vote the time they file, they shall provide to the division proof of residency in the form of, and we do lay that in regulation in another section related to, as Representative Samuels discussed, should a candidate be challenged, should there be a complaint filed, we do require that type of proof from the candidate, and the burden is on the candidate. We could do that in regulation following to this language.
And I'm just concerned that this says it must state that, and that the candidate is registered to vote in that district. That's at the time of certificate. That's at the at the declaration of candidacy.
At the time they file.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether you can modify that by saying, oh, you don't have to fulfill that. You can supply us some other information to be a resident. I don't think. Yes, Representative Grimberg.
Okay. You raised a couple of issues, Mr. Chair.
Right. And just for the committee's consideration, what I'd like to do, if this is something that's complicated and we need to revise the language, I'd like to have the amendment, withdraw the amendment from consideration, get the language right among the parties and reintroduce it the next meeting on this bill. So this doesn't have to be our only shot at this. So if there's any concern by the Division of Elections, if we're accomplishing the full intent of this amendment, that's what I'd like to do. Yes, Representative Groomberg.
Several things. First of all, this definitely places the burden on the candidate. Secondly, I believe that the division could do the other stuff by regulation. Third, and this gets to what the chair was saying, looking again at section, Article 2, Section 2, the way I read it, and let me read the first sentence now, and then my interpretation. A member of the legislature shall be a qualified voter who has been a resident of Alaska for at least 3 years and of the district from which elected for at least 1 year immediately preceding his filing for office. Now, it says you have to be a resident of the district and Alaska, of course, for the year prior to filing for office. It doesn't say you have to be a qualified voter for the year. You could be a resident for the year and register to vote before file for office. Before you take your office. That's my interpretation. This would require you to be registered on the time you file for office, a year before this would require you to be a registered voter at the time you file for office. I don't think that this language in the Constitution requires you to be a qualified voter until you take office. And I'd like a legal opinion on that.
Okay, and the other question is, you would have to be registered in that to vote in that district, and that's the...
True.
That's true. That is the thing that I think we need to work on. Representative Samuels?
True. Thank you. We can certainly work on the amendment. We could do it here. We could do it in the next committee. The point, I don't care if you're a registered voter 1 day before you take office. My point of the amendment is proving the residency, and I think you hit it on the head. The presumption is if you're registered to vote for the requisite year, then we're going to presume you are a resident. If you're not, then you have to prove you are a resident. We don't, the voting, registered voter, but we're trying to presume so that I don't move into your district and say I live here. I only moved into your district a month before the filing deadline. I register to vote in your district, and I say that I've been there. If somebody doesn't file a complaint against me within 10 days, even though I've only lived there for a month, no complaint can now be filed, and I'm qualified to run, even though I have not been the resident. And we're trying to have the presumption of the residency is what we're trying to get to.
And that's where we're trying to get to, and I'm not sure we have the right language here, and I don't want to try to get that here, so we'll... Withdraw this amendment.
I withdraw the amendment.
The amendment number 4 is withdrawn, and we will work on this some more later. Thank you. And now, if we would put 94 to the bottom of our pile here, I don't think we're going to get back to it, but we've got a pile
before the next election.
And now we have before us House Bill 98, and if we could have the administration come forward to and Mr. Tibbles, if you'd identify yourself for the record, and I would like to apologize for having held you here so long, but elections are pretty important things. And
understand that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill today. For the record, my name is Mike Tibbles, Deputy Commissioner at Department of Administration. I will very simply explain what the bill does and talk about why this bill is so important to our workforce in the state. The bill matches up, the bill proposes to match up the statutory pay schedule that applies to partially exempt and exempt employees in the legislative, judicial, and the executive branch with the statutory schedules that have been negotiated recently under the collective bargaining agreements. There are really two parts. The first part is the matchup part that will bring the statutory schedule in line with the current contracts, and the second part is the tracking of the contracts going forward, which have been negotiated for fiscal year FY06 and fiscal year FY07. We had offered a 0-2-2 proposal to most of the bargaining units, and you will see monetary terms submitted to the legislature that have been submitted to the legislature already this year, and monetary terms that have been approved last year for a number of the bargaining units. So this bill, as we see it, is an equity issue that will bring the statutory schedule again for those employees on the in partially exempt and exempt service in line with the contracts negotiated under collective bargaining. As a comment about process, the Division of Personnel can establish ranges through the classification process for particular job classes. However, the dollar amount for a particular range, for example, the range 21, is established by one of two mechanisms. One is through collective bargaining, and we negotiate with the unions to reach an agreement on what the dollar amount should be, and the other is to go to the legislature and adjust the statutory schedule, and that's what we're doing in this particular bill. We are required, when we want to amend the dollar amounts for the ranges for the employees that are covered under a statutory schedule, we're required to present a bill to the legislature and request that it be upgraded and equalized. And historically, that has happened. We've seen, we can look back over the years, and when new contracts are negotiated, the administration does come forward with a bill to equalize the pay for the partially exempt and exempts. Let me speak briefly, and then I'd like to take some questions about why this bill is so important to our workforce. The first one is simply just an equity issue. By the time that we reach the end of the current negotiated contracts under the, we have 11 collective bargaining agreements, by the time we reach the end of these three-year contracts, there will be a 9% disparity between the statutory schedule, pay schedule, and the agreed, not all, but most of the collective bargaining agreements. We feel if employees are doing similar work, they should be paid similarly, and 9% is a very big disparity, and certainly a morale issue for employees. On top of that, there are issues regarding career progression, and when we see a disparity to this extent of 9%, there certainly is not an incentive to move up into management when one salary schedule is 9% different, and the potential impact is that you would make less money, which we do see now, at working at the supervisor of a supervisor or upper level management. And the third issue is really just a straight recruitment issue. Mr. Chairman, we have certain areas, which I know some of those areas you're familiar with, that have demonstrated recruitment problems. And when we get to a 9% disparity, we've I think just add to our problem with being able to recruit qualified applicants and candidates for filling the state jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Lynn.
I'd just like to put on the record the answer to this question. Does this in any way affect legislative salary?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, this bill does not affect the salary of legislators.
Thank you.
The salary is established in statute.
Yeah, I knew that, but I wanted that to be on the record.
Thank you. Other questions? I had a question that I just want to pose, and that's on page 3. We're at the top where we're saying that the salary adjustments the employees are entitled to receive salary adjustments comparable to those of the classified and partially exempt employees. Rather than adopting a specific number and saying that they receive the same wages, is that, or the same salary? Is, does that become a problem of attaching those two together at all?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand, we have employees in the executive branch, and you'll see this, the section that applies to the judicial branch, that are not paid off of this salary schedule. And what these sections would apply, for example, on the Section 5 for the judicial branch, you have the salary for judges. While it's not listed, they're not listed exactly on this schedule. What the bill would do, it would apply the same percentage increases to those employees that the employees that are on the schedule would receive.
Okay, thank you, Ann. I guess, does anyone else have any other questions? Yes, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just curious about the word entitled. It occurs in several places, and I'm not sure if that's the intent, otherwise not covered, are entitled to receive. Well, that pretty well eliminates the need for legislation. If a person is entitled to receive something, then we don't need to address it here, do we?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, it's, of course, all of this is subject to appropriation. However, this is the standard language that is included over historically with the statutory pay increases where an employee, and it's language that's used just to make sure that it's very clear that if there is a 2% increase and the employee is not being paid off of that statutory schedule, that they would be entitled to receive that same 2%.
Representative Groomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is standard language, but I have a question here, and I'm going to guess at what your answer is going to be, Mr. Tibble. Section 6, is this standard language that we turn all the authority, we delegate all of our authority concerning the pay of employees, non-represented employees, in the university over to the Board of Regents?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Groomberg, I can't provide you a historical perspective on that, but the answer to your question is yes, from my knowledge of the time that I've been involved.
My second question, this is my day for constitutional issues, I guess. Can we constitutionally delegate our authority to another branch of government like this? We haven't done that anywhere else in here. We have specifically said for the judicial branch what they shall be. That's not delegating our authority. This is delegating our authority, and I'm wondering if we can constitutionally do that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Groomberg, I think what we've done is what we have, we maybe delegated is not the correct word, but we've authorized the university to establish their own classification and pay plans. And they do not operate on our salary ranges or steps. They have a completely separate pay plan, and they classify their employees completely different than the state of Alaska. So it wouldn't be appropriate to apply.
No, excuse me, through the chair. I'm not suggesting it. It was simply whether we have to set it out in statute or not. I'm not going to pursue that, but I just want to be sure.
Yeah, Representative Groomberg, am I? I have got a copy of the 1991 laws here, and it reads, employees of the University of Alaska, employees of the university who are not members of the collective bargaining, et cetera, are
receiving the same language.
Same language.
So there's precedent. Okay, yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Do I hear a motion from the committee on HB 98?
I move House Bill 98 with attached fiscal note.
And individual recommendation?
Individual recommendations.
Yes. You have an objection?
I want to introduce an amendment.
I withdraw my vote.
Thank you. Representative Elkin?
It's just a technical amendment on page 2, line 30. I think it should, two should be underlined and in bold and original wording should be three, should be bracketed. This amendment is a small technical problem. It really doesn't, it's just a difference between what the intent of the drafters wanted and a legal wording for attorneys, but I think it makes it a better.
Mr. Gibbles.
Mr. Chairman, if I may speak to that. If you look at 3927.011F, you will see that the existing language does refer to a 3%. So to conform this bill with legislative drafting style, you would delete the 3% by putting them in the brackets and then insert to bold and underline, as Representative Elkins had mentioned. Consider this a technical amendment and support
thank,
that.
Thank you. That's a conceptual amendment, so we'll let the drafters conform. Is there any objection? Yes. Is there an objection to the amendment?
Just for the purpose of discussion,
yes,
for a moment.
Representative Hoover.
I'm trying to turn to 3927. My question is, here we are, 011, okay. Subsection, okay, that says two. Yes, okay. I removed my objection. I was wondering whether we had to do
there
that.
Any in further objections? No objections. That amendment is adopted. Do I hear a motion on the bill?
Yes, I move House Bill 98 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections? It will be.
Look at that.
It passed, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.